mana la joy madir e
from Senegal, the late Julia Juga and Julia Juga's chorale, and master percussionist Dudu Ndiaye Rose with Ele YY. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Friday, March the 20th, and a mighty tree has fallen. Dr. Yosef Ben-Yohanan, world-renowned scholar of African history and among the last of his generation to dedicate themselves to retrieving the missing pages, passed away yesterday. We will remember him in the second half of the program. But first, the National Urban League refuses to take a hint. With customary officiousness, the National Urban League yesterday released its annual State of the Union, as it were, report on America, statistically qualifying and quantifying how people of color, especially African Americans and Latinos, are faring. The news was not good. America today is a tale of two nations. It is a tale of two Americas, Urban League President Marc Morial announced, both referencing and still avoiding the irony that a blue ribbon panel appointed by President Lyndon B. Johnson back in the 1960s to look into the waves of urban rebellions that erupted in America had reached the same conclusion. So we'll take a look at this and why I'm going to suggest that the National Urban League perhaps needs to take hints, not just the National Urban League, by the way, but the National Urban League in the sense that it issued this report, so we can start there, but it has implications throughout the world of advocacy, especially for minorities in the United States, and we'll talk about that word as well. But first, let's hear a report. Here's a fast summary of this report, about the report.
The Urban League report finds the biggest problem facing African Americans is not their treatment by police.
Shut it down!
Or what students at University of Virginia charged last night was mistreatment after student Martise Johnson was bloodied by cops. The report finds social justice for blacks improving, less crime and violence, but finds a stunning and worsening economic gap between white Americans and African Americans, who now have a median net worth of just $6,300 versus $111,000 for whites. Black income is $35,000 versus $58,000 for whites. And the black unemployment rate is more than double the rate for whites. It's a tale of two nations, says Mark Morial, the head of the Urban League.
This is not a sustainable thing for the United States of America, and we're a nation that believes that upward economic mobility is tied to education, perseverance, and hard work.
Not race.
Not race.
Two steps forward and one step back.
Frustrated African American leaders today demanded better schools and job training.
Our young boys, especially, are falling further and further behind.
Fix that, says the Urban League, and we'd lessen the friction that led to the racism found by the Justice Department in Ferguson and suspected in other communities across America. The Urban League says economically, Hispanics in America are doing a bit better than blacks, but on net worth and income are also falling far behind whites. I'm Steve Handelsman, NBC News, Washington.
Well, I'm sure a couple of things that were said there were a little bit shocking to you. They certainly shocked me that there is a conclusion now, and this is now official because a major advocacy organization has said racism is not the problem. It is not the problem. It's economic inequality that is the problem. So we have the Urban League, the National Urban League, that was founded to essentially rid this country of racism, is saying pretty much racism isn't a problem so much. It is economic inequality. And if we fix economic inequality, we will have a just and righteous society. I beg to differ, because the statistics are saying that even economic inequality is race-based. So you can't get away from this issue of racism in the United States. It is an apartheid system at every single level. It is mind-boggling that the Urban League will come to the conclusion and will put out there that, in effect, it is not a problem. It is not the most important problem either. Now, what is fascinating here is the shift, and the shift is moving in accordance with the shift that is being demanded in corporate America and certainly in governmental circles. Let's get away from this racism thing. It is over. It is done with. We are in post-racial America, folks. We're onto something else. What is this obsession that you have with race? The problem, obviously, is with you, black folks, Latinos. The problem is with you, with this obsession that you have. We're beyond that now. And yet we see that in every sphere of influence, every important field of endeavor, every aspect of society, it shows its ugly head. And it is a permanent and flawed thread in the fabric of American life. But we have the Urban League, the National Urban League, expunging this nation of the blame, and NBC very, very compliantly follows up with a report, even starting out with, you didn't see it because it's from a video clip, but it starts out with the actual scenes of people being beaten by police and the bloodied student from the University of Virginia. But Handelsman's voice over all of that saying, this is not the problem. You're looking at it, but according to the National Urban League, this isn't the problem. The problem is economics. And what does Mark Morial, the president of the National Urban League, say? It is about providing people the opportunity to work hard and to basically improve their lives. You know, those are the kinds of buzzwords that we have heard for a long time coming from essentially white America. If you only applied yourself, if you only buckle down and work hard, you will progress in life. You will prosper. And this obsession you have with race is going to just retard your progress. It's going to work against you if your mind is so preoccupied with this business of being oppressed on the basis of race. Get over it and move on and take advantage of the opportunities that are before you. So the issue is economic inequality. Now, there's no way to argue against that. Economic inequality is a huge issue. But when has it not been? When has it not been? Well, let's make a note here. This is the 39th annual report from the National Urban League. And this year's report sounds remarkably like last year's report. Last year's report sounded remarkably like the year before's. And that year's report sounded remarkably like the year before that. We have been hearing the same theme for several years, if not decades now. Some progress has been made in this area and in that area. We've seen some movement. But by and large, as Marc Morial himself uses the word, we are in crisis. Well, I think 39 reports is enough not only to verify that there is a crisis, but it should be interpreted in an entirely different way. It should suggest to the intelligent people compiling these reports that there isn't anything new. There isn't any major movement beyond the prescribed areas within which blacks are allowed to function, and barely so. So what is the point of repeating the same theme every year and still miss the implications of your own report? The implication, number one, is the system is working very well, very efficiently. It is doing exactly what it was designed to do. You're quantifying it every year. A white supremacist system is doing exactly what a white supremacist system is designed to do. It promotes racial inequality, economic inequality, political inequality, any kind of inequality you want. That's what it's designed for. So when you present these figures as if to say, here is the problem, it should occur to you that you're saying, here is the problem again. Here's some more evidence of the problem. You are verifying that the system is working very, very well. It is producing predictable results. It is devastating and destroying an undesirable population. That's what it's doing. That's what you've been quantifying for 39 years. Get a hint. Take a hint. The other piece of it is that the National Urban League is missing here, is that it should suggest that if you keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, we're going to get the same results over and over and over again. Maybe it is time that advocacy organizations like the National Urban League really do a self-audit and retool to to fight, to actually fight, not just do the business of quantifying and putting out statistics, which are put out, by the way, every single month. You want to know about unemployment? You don't have to wait for a whole year to find out what the unemployment picture looks like. The U.S. Department of Labor Statistics produces a report every month. And every month, it makes that notation. If anybody bothers to go to the back of the report, after it describes what the general economic picture is as it pertains to employment and unemployment, it breaks it down by race. And every report, every single report has annotated that the unemployment rate for African Americans is at least, if not more, than twice the national average. Every report is saying that. So we don't have to wait for the grand release of an annual report, which is basically affirming what has been put out every single month. In every sphere here that has been looked at, whether it's education, employment, housing, whatever it is you want to look at, these reports are readily available. And they are produced every month by none other than the government itself. And the government repeatedly lets the public know that it is maintaining an apartheid system. So when you, with great, you know, a grand news conference and all of this stuff, and, you know, we have the great pronouncement, as if this should come as a shock, what he said about America being two Americas, separate and unequal kind of thing. Lyndon Baines Johnson's Blue Ribbon Commission, the Kerner Commission of 1968, said that in 1968. This is 2015. And you're offering this observation as a keen analysis. The National Urban League and organizations like it, like the NAACP and so forth, these reports are annoying in that you continue to validate the existence of the problem. And you refuse to take a hint that it is time to retool for a fight, to actually get involved in combat with a system. Not accommodation with it. Not apologizing for it, but to fight it, if in fact you're in the business of advocacy. What does that mean? It means if you truly have a mission to improve the lot of an oppressed group of people, you can't be in the master's house. You just can't. You will have to maintain some kind of a separate identity here. You can't be so close to the system and then say you're going to fight it. You can't be in bed with it and then say you're fighting it. You can't be compromised and then present yourself as completely independent of the political system, which you're supposed to be fighting. Marc Morial yesterday should have been on fire, particularly because, as a Democrat, he was a former mayor of New Orleans. One of the areas he talked about was education. The city that he used to be mayor of no longer has a public school. There is no public school left in New Orleans, where he was mayor. But he will not attack the Obama administration, which has closed more schools than any other president in the history of the United States. And not just in New Orleans. Privatizing public education, using Black and Latino children almost exclusively as part of a burgeoning industry, a profit-centered burgeoning industry, which, by the way, by all accounts, is underperforming spectacularly. But you can't attack Obama, who has destroyed your own city, because you're a Democrat. You're in bed with the Democrats. You're in bed with the administration. He's your buddy. And maybe you have political aspirations beyond being president of the National Urban League. You're going to have an afterlife, and it probably is political, and you can't mess up by insulting or embarrassing the Democratic Party for its racism. You can't do that and survive. So you put out a report, and the issue now becomes the report, as opposed to the spinelessness of these kinds of organizations. Oh, we have made a little progress here, and we have made a little progress there. But, you know, it's about economic inequality. No, the problem in America has not changed at all at base level. It's race oppression. Yes, it expresses itself as a more than twice the national average of unemployment for Blacks, but it's race. It expresses itself as a complete absence of public schools in New Orleans and the shutting down of schools in Chicago and the complete obliteration of schools in Detroit, but it's race. All of these children that are displaced and all of these children that are shuttled into a profit-making system, they're Black and Latino children. So don't tell me it's about educational inequality. It's race. It's at the root of it. Don't tell me the issue, well, you know, the issue is about crime. Well, crime is related to race. We see that. That he says, as a matter of fact, in this report, well, there's been an improvement here. There isn't as much crime as there used to be. Well, what does that mean? How do you arrive at that? If there's not as much crime as there used to be, how come we have all of these prisons across the jails and prisons across America just crammed with mostly Black bodies and Latino men? How did that happen? So how are you really assessing these figures and assembling these statistics? How are you choosing to interpret them? And to come out of all of that with all this, the figures and the facts, are the big flurry of statistics, but it's all designed to tell America racism is done. It's over with. It really isn't our major problem. Our major problem right now is jobs, as if that does not involve race. Issue is jobs? Okay, the issue is jobs. So how come we are not getting jobs? How is it, according to the statistics, a white person who is a high school dropout has better chances of employment than an African American with a college degree? How is it when you talk about immigration, you miss the point that the most educated immigrant into the United States is Nigerian, followed by Egyptian. That comes from the government. And yet, immigration policy does not favor immigration from Nigeria. It does not favor immigration from Egypt. And you're going to tell me it's not about race. It's about economic opportunity. What is this shell game that is going on? These organizations have missed the boat, and what they have essentially become are bastions of middle-class professionals who earn a nice living producing reports and engaging, quote-unquote, with the system in meetings and conferences. But there is a huge divide between their world and the world in which the vast majority of the people they allegedly are advocating for are living day to day. Which is why Eric Holder, the U.S. Attorney General, was even stunned at his own report. Stunned that apartheid exists in Ferguson, Missouri. Stunned. That's that was the popular word. It was a stunning report. What was so stunning? As I said, it's stunning only to those people who have been disconnected from these communities, have no idea what's going on in them, and yet walk around with portfolios representing them. This is a problem I have with the National Urban League and organizations like it, the NAACP and these other organizations. Their own reports, their own analyses, their own investigations are and have been telling them over and over again what the problems are, which means that the problems have been systemic and still are systemic. When you put out 39 reports, I think it's reasonable to assume, when you see a pattern that's lasting for decades, I think it's reasonable to assume that these problems have not gone away. Therefore, I think it's also reasonable to assume it might have been designed that way. And therefore, the approach of an advocacy organization is to develop the skills and tools to take on the system that is producing these very undesirable results. That is to say, you prepare yourself as an organization to be understood as a fighting organization. We are not here to make nice. We're not here to have lovely little meetings in downtown hotels and conferences and sip tea. We're not here to ameliorate anything. We're here to fight. We're here to take you on. We're here to compel you to behave differently. We're here with demands. That's what these organizations ought to be communicating. But instead, it is so much safer to be part of to dance on both sides of the fence. You're part of the problem, but you're telling other people you're part of the solution. In the case of the National Urban League, Marc Morial, as I said, Marc Morial is very clear. He is a friend of the administration. He will not publicly criticize this administration. He will not condemn it for its passivity in the face of extraordinary suffering of the people who elected Barack Obama and elected him in New Orleans. And what does he say in this report, which irritates the heck out of me, as you know, apart from the fact that this is not about race, it's really about income inequality. The way you fix this, he says, is that the people have to summon up their character. They have to work hard. The same tired, annoying, patronizing message that we've gotten from Barack Obama, as if black people especially need coaching in this area. We don't know that hard work is important. We have no idea about that. But the solution, he says, is now one that is character-based. And, of course, Barack Obama's favorite ending note, the vote. We've got to get you to vote. Without obviously explaining that there's a connection between a vote and the perception that there's something worth voting for. But the president has decided that this is a character flaw. If you don't vote, there is something wrong with you. Not that there's something wrong with a system that gives you no reason whatsoever to vote. What are you voting for? You voting for your own continued oppression? You voting for inequality? You voting for corruption? You're voting for a bunch of people who have no intention whatsoever to do the right thing, to do the just thing. Vote for them? This is amazing. It is an amazing thing that happened yesterday. How you could at once recognize the problem and publicly deny it at the same time. But that's the history of civil rights organizations, especially of late. They didn't start out that way. They started out when Ida B. Wells was part of the National Urban League. That was a fight. She was a fighter. She fought even the people in the Urban League. The NAACP, the fighters. Here we are, with all the niceties, all the props in place, that, by the way, it's the first all-digital, they kept pumping on their website, it's the first all-digital report. That's progress. You see? Great progress. People got paid a lot of money to put those figures together in a nice report and everything, because in the end, it is about marketing. It is to be marketed to corporations who will say, look, you're doing the right thing. You're educating your people. You're doing the right thing. Here's a cool $500,000. And in turn, they will say to other corporations who are too slow on the draw, look what we're doing. We're telling these people that they have to step up. They have to have the guts, they have to have the courage to improve themselves. We are telling them the issue is not race. We have submitted a proposal. I don't know if you've looked at it, but we're just asking for $1.2 million this year. This is the problem. Compromised leadership. And telling us that the problem is something else. But definitively, as of yesterday, America, all of America is on notice that African Americans complaining about racism are just psychologically, they're kind of twisted. They're obsessed. They should know by now that it's about the money. It's economic inequality. That's the issue. And the president says it, And now a leading civil rights organization has said it. Amen, and bring your souls to the polls. We take this break and come back and talk about a really sensible man, a really formidable foe of racism.
Ginchacha gine, madire ya yetenga yendoko. Ginchacha gine,
madire ya yetenga yendoko. Ginchacha gine,
madire ya.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. As I said at the opening of this program today, a note of sorrow, but not complete sorrow. A mighty tree has fallen, and it is Dr. Yosef Ben Yohanan, who is revered around the world, especially within the African diaspora, as the last, perhaps one of the last of his generation of scholars to dedicate his life to restoring not only the missing pages, retrieving and restoring the missing pages of our history of Africans in the diaspora, but also situating Africa in its proper place as being central to world civilization. This was and continues to be an extraordinary effort because, as we know, and we discuss this here all the time, the point of white supremacy, the point of this global philosophy is to erase the histories of people, and many of them with great civilizations, and to supplant it with a different view of the world, one that is decidedly Eurocentric. I happen to have known Dr. Yohanan, very funny man, very down to earth, but everybody has gotten to know him pretty much because he made himself available to everyone who was interested, seriously interested in history, seriously interested in learning. I've lost count of the numbers of community forums that he would appear in, doing classes, whether one person or 1,000 should show up, it didn't matter to him. And of course, he was the running buddy and close friend and collaborator with Dr. John Henrik Clark. They were like scholarly twins. They worked so well together and were very dear friends. Dr. Clark's death in 1998 at the age of 83 was a serious emotional blow to Dr. Yohanan. He died yesterday at the age of 97. And just we should pause today just to remember him and to say thank you. And to do so, here's a little bit of a very long lecture he gave at Tuskegee Institute. He's talking to the students there, and in his own way, and whenever Dr. Ben spoke, you were always on edge to say, "Oh, is he going to go there?" And he invariably did go there. So here's Dr. Ben, and we say, and we remember him, and we say thank you for all of your years of dedicated work.
I would like to first express my appreciation for your invitation. It took me 50 years to get to Tuskegee. 50 years ago, at age 16, I applied for entrance to Tuskegee. My application was accepted, but the immigration laws of the United States of America were such, and I don't think they have changed much, that I couldn't get here. I remember that such had happened to a man before me by the name of Marcus Messiah Garvey. He was invited by Booker T. Washington. I don't know if you know about him. I heard you don't have a Booker T. Washington Day. Unusual. But anyhow, probably better thoughts may come about and there will be a Booker T. Washington Day at Tuskegee. But anyhow, Marcus Messiah Garvey was invited by Booker T. Washington to come to the United States. The facts are that red tapes in the Immigration Department, Garvey arrived 6 months subsequent to the death of the great Booker T. Washington. So, taking 50 years to get here, nevertheless, I got here. I do not know if I would have taken the course of action in my life that I have now taken. However, I was lucky enough to slip through an engineering course and graduate and a few more courses, and here I am. Within the context of my education, if you could call it that, I would prefer to call it the course of my indoctrination, my training, which started in Ethiopia, East Africa, and continued in Brazil, Cuba, Puerto Rico, the United States, Virgin Islands, England, and Spain. Been around a few places. And in all of these places that I've been, I never once received an education in the history of African people. Yet I thought that I've educated myself down through those period of time. And it is because of that self-education in those things which meant most to me as an African person that I decided at no time would I stand still in these halls of indoctrination and not rebel with the necessary documentation of the lies that are being taught in these halls. And so I may be saying things that may hurt many of you, if not most of you, because some of the lies have become your dear frame of reference. We could start with the Greeks. I hope you of fraternities and sororities don't get too bothered about it, since the Greeks weren't too much anyhow. But we can start with that, because there is where our institutions of learning has decided to start civilization. Yet the Greeks are only here from at least 1,000 before the common era, or before the Christian era, as you would prefer to say. Let us just, for example, cite one. And that particular person would be Hippocrates. And I'm sure that you heard of Hippocrates. And when you consider that Hippocrates wasn't born until 333 BC, or before the Common Era, yet in your education you were told that Hippocrates is the father of medicine. That's a lie. There's no way that I can say about it other than it's a lie. A lie is a lie, whether it's in the university or in the church. How could Hippocrates be the father of medicine when the first time you see him, he is in Egypt learning medicine from Africans? There are numerous papyri, medical papyri, on medicine. The nearest to Hippocrates is at least 1,300 years before he was born. For example, we have what is known as the Hettus Papyrus, the Ebers Papyrus, and now the so-called Rockefeller Papyrus, the Edwin C. Smith Papyrus. All of these papyri go back to as early as 3100 BC. The man who Hippocrates took an oath that he would practice medicine according to this man, this African, whom the Greeks call Aesculapius, in the Hippocratic Oath, a man by the name of Imhotep, died. He practiced medicine and died 2,500 years before the birth of Hippocrates. And you are telling me that the medical school and the pre-medical historians don't know this? They don't know it because, unfortunately, Imhotep had a high visibility like myself, otherwise called black. They don't know that the Ebers Papyrus by Hatshepsut, dealing with Planned Parenthood, I said Planned Parenthood, 1,550 years before the birth of Jesus the Christ, is out there, when every medical journal in 1961 published copies of the Ebers Papyrus. And we could go on with the papyri with respect to all kinds of diseases that the Africans had produced, both in Egypt and Ethiopia and Sudan and a place then called Pointe, now called Somalia. But that would be satisfactory. But let us take the kind of education that we do have. We are in a chapel, and we have been told about an immaculate conception and virgin birth. We have been told about the beginning of the world with Adam and Eve. We have been told about a man by the name of Cain who slew his brother Abel. And we have been told that all of these things only happened once. And they go back to the Old Testament, or otherwise called the Torah, or the Pentateuch, or the Kumish. Those are names for what you call the Old Testament. But we have never been told that they are only copies of stories that predated them by thousands of years. Let us read them one by one. I heard some hmms and everything already. Oh yes, you have been told a lot of lies. No other way to talk about it. And those who teach them, if in fact they did any research, must know they are lies. That is providing that they have never gone to Egypt or to Ethiopia or to Sudan to see the living proof. The writings on the tombs, the writings in the pyramids, what is called the pyramid text and the coffin text. That is providing that they have not seen the holy scriptures of the Africans of the Nile Valley, otherwise called the Egyptian Book of the Dead, or as Budge called it in his translation of the hieratic writing, or the Egyptian Book of the Coming Forth by Day and by Night. In the temple of Seti I, for example, at a place called Abydos, not only is there the writings of an immaculate conception 4,000 years before the story of Mary, but it is there in picture form. Are we to say that the theologians of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam have never once taken a trip to Egypt, from whence these things were taken? In that same temple, you see a story of how Ctesiphon murdered his brother Osiris 2,000 years before the Jewish story of Cain and Abel. And we are told that an African from Egypt by the name of Moses, born in the city of Goshen, that's still Egypt. Egypt is in Africa, by the way, the last time I saw it in January. You heard of a place called Middle East? I don't know of any place called Middle East. That's political jingoism. But we can find that there was no Moses on Mount Horeb in the Sinai to receive any Ten Commandments that had not been given before or written before in Egypt, because you could go in the Book of the Coming Forth by Day and by Night, the Book of the Dead, and see in what is called the Osirian drama, not only those 10, but 32 more, a total of 42, which you can also go in the temple of Ramesses the Sixth, in the Valley of the Kings, across what is today called Luxor. And in that tomb, you would see the 42 listed commandments, or otherwise negative confession, 2,000 years before the birth of Moses. But they told you that Moses was taught. He was an Egyptian, taught in school in Egypt, and became a priest in the system. Could you have been born in the United States of America, went to kindergarten, then elementary school, junior high school, and never heard of the United States Constitution? It was equally impossible for Moses to have born in Egypt, go to school in Egypt, study in an Egyptian system, worship God Amun-Ra, and never once heard of the 42 negative confession, which have in it, thou shalt not kill. I have not killed man nor woman. I have not made like thy bushel. I have not. Moses himself is charged with murder. His brother Aaron is charged with theft. 40 years before they reached Mount Sinai, then somebody had a law against theft and against murder before he reached Mount Sinai. Where did they get it? But you weren't taught anything about this. All of this information have been suppressed at a place called the Council of Jamia and the Council of Nicene in 325 AD, when Constantine the Roman Emperor conquered North Africa, took over the role of the Christian church, which started in Alexandria with Pantheus and Boethius, not in Rome. But this too you have not been taught. You have not been taught that the three people who died first in the name of Jesus the Christ were three African women: Felicita, Nymphano, and Perpetua. Yet you know everything. You're born again. You know it all. You can't be blamed for it. Even your teachers may not be able to be blamed for this, because one can't teach what one doesn't know, or one have not learned, or one have not experienced, because there is no interest for people to go to Egypt to see anything but to go to the Holy Land. And that's why Jesse is tied and had to get on his knees and pray and beg forgiveness. He was scared he wouldn't be able to get back in the Holy Land for saying what was right. But there's more than that. Because you have been told that unless Europeans teach you, you haven't been taught. But who told you that the first university built in all of Europe was built by Africans called Moors at the university, what is called the University of Salamanca in Spain? Check it out. Europe's first university. Not only the stones were put together like the stones in most of the building and the bricks in most of the building here. I'm not talking about that aspect of only the building. I'm talking about the educational system is nothing but a copy of the University of Gene, D-J-E-N-N-E, of ancient Ghana, which was burnt down and rebuilt as the University of Sankore in the city of Tumbuk, which the French later called Timbuktu. Then carried, as the Africans called Moors, conquered Iberia, now Spain and Portugal and southern France, and established in there the university system. And as I said before, it was not the first. The earliest of the Greeks were trained in a place called the subordinate lodge of Croton and Delphi. Subordinate lodges of the Grand Lodge in a place called Waset, which the Greeks later changed to Thebes or Thebes. The current Arabs changed it to Luxor. But did you get that in Greek philosophy? Did you get it in Greek history or European history? None whatsoever. And how did you get?
Dr. Yosef Ben Yochanan, just giving you a taste of how he taught and what he taught, and just remember him this day. Stay tuned right here at PRN.FM, great programming coming up. And you would want to reach me I would love to hear from you at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Of course, we are hoping that we will be able soon to have vigorous dialogue with each other. They're working on it as I speak. So we're looking forward to next week. And until then, please know that I consider it a great privilege to be in your company every day, Monday through Friday. Have yourselves a great weekend. You'll connect again on Monday. Bye-bye.
Madire ya yetenga yendo.